Welcome to Tomorrow's Transactions, the Consult Hyperion podcast series. I'm Dave Birch from Consult Hyperion. This week we're doing a bit of paleontology in the cards business because we're looking at the dawn of cards and understanding a little bit about the trajectory of the cards business, which set it on the route to where it is now. And the reason we're doing this is because I bumped into
Lana Swartz, and I am a PhD candidate at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California.
And we had the most bizarre connection because I happened to mention, I'm a very dull person at dinner parties, as evidenced by my conversation about the 1963 Danny Kaye classic, The Man from Diners Club, which I was mentioning because I thought it was a very interesting case study in the history of cards marketing. Only to discover that Lana knew absolutely everything about it. And I simply couldn't resist dragooning her into talking about it. So tell us a little bit about this movie. How did this movie come about?
Well, one of the early executives of the Diners Club was Alfred Bloomingdale, heir to the Bloomingdale's department store fortune. And he, of course, was very good friends with an executive at Columbia Pictures. And the story goes that one day, poolside, Alfred Bloomingdale suggested that they make a movie about Diners Club. And if you've seen the movie, which I think you have, you'll know that it's not good.
It's not a great movie. I don't like Danny Kaye movies anyway.
I love Danny Kaye, but I don't like this movie. The plot is thin. But an interesting thing about the movie is that probably the only good scene in the whole movie is one where Danny Kaye, who's this very meek, nebbishy, can I say that?
Yeah, we'll have a translation.
Okay. junior executive at Diners Club goes into a room where the computer is held. And the computer takes up the whole room. There's tons of it's powered by cards. It basically looks like a gigantic Rolodex. And the computer operator is a very mean woman who won't let anyone touch the computer but her. And she refers to it as her baby. And the computer gives Danny Kaye a nervous condition. He can't stand the sound. He can't stand the blinking lights, which for some reason this computer is just absolutely covered in blinking lights.
I think they all were in 1963.
Were they? I don't know. Did they have like a double punch cards?
Is there big whirling tape?
Yeah. But because he's gotten himself into a bunch of trouble with a gangster, I would explain the plot, but like I said, it really doesn't make sense. He has to retrieve a particular punch card from it, which triggers all the cards to shower down upon him like confetti. What's ironic about that is that at the time, 1963, the Diners Club wasn't computerized at all. It didn't have computers. The early executives, in fact, were quite proud of their very extensive and effective use of good old-fashioned carbon paper. Another funny thing about the movie is that just as coming up with a sort of poorly plotted movie, the Diners Club marketing department came up with a fairly poorly plotted marketing scheme. They convinced the town of Winsted, Connecticut, to host them and abolish the use of cash for one whole day, for 24 hours. And the reason why Winsted agreed is because they had previously had a train line from New York City to Winsted that had been discontinued, and they were hoping that the publicity would help them get their train line back. But also, journalists who were meant to come cover the event couldn't get there by train, so very few of them wound up coming. Also,
it's a chicken and egg.
Unfortunately, it fell on the same day as a newspaper strike, so not a lot of journalists came. The journalists who did arrive found that everyone in the town had been issued a Diners Club card, disallowed from using cash for that 24 hours. They had even set up a set of stocks, you know, that symbol of old-time New England Protestant justice where debtors and also not-so-nice people would have their hands and arms put in.
We call it the good old days.
So everyone in town had been given a Diners Club card, except for, of course, the journalists, who, rather than subject themselves to this punishment, decided to just basically go hungry. So the event was not widely covered, and it was a notorious disaster.
But the point about the film is, like, there are several points in the film mm-hmm. where the plot has to diverge to mm-hmm. actively explain what a card is and how it works. You know, there's scenes of people ringing up for authorization, mm-hmm. and there are the girls in the authorization center looking through the files, mm-hmm. and all this kind of thing. Because obviously the audience didn't know mm-hmm. what, I mean, that was the point of the movie, right? The audience didn't know what a card was. Mm-hmm. So this is 15 years or so into Dinah's existence, right?
About
so,
13, yeah.
Yeah, so let's just back up a little bit. Where did Dinah's come from? Because Dinah's is touted as the first modern card, right?
Right, well, according to myth, and this is widely believed to not be true, but nevertheless, it's a great story. Yeah. Frank McNamara, the original founder of Diners Club, was a businessman. It's not really described what his business was, but before Diners Club. But he was taking a client to dinner in New York City, and all of a sudden he realized that he didn't have any cash on him. So in order to avoid embarrassment and in order to avoid him, you know, having to roll up his sleeves and wash some dishes in the back of the restaurant, his wife drove into town all the way from Long Island on the highway with a scowl on her face and, by some accounts, curlers in her hair to bring him some money. And McNamara decided then and there that no responsible businessman should ever face such a situation again. Yeah, that everyone should be able to have a way of paying, every person who deserved it should have a way of paying for something, whether or not they had cash on them at that moment. The thing you have to remember about this time, which was about 1950, is all of a sudden people were moving much faster and further than they had before. In the United States, we built the highway system, democratized jet travel, this new class of traveling businessmen, middle managers making business trips. But the banking system was largely decentralized, and you couldn't just go up on any corner to an ATM and withdraw cash.
So what did Frank do?
So he began to, he had this idea to come up with the Diners Club card, which crucially was not a credit card, but a charge card. People could not keep a balance. It had to be paid off at the end of every month. And he began recruiting from mostly within the New York City nightclub and restaurant circuit to try to find various businesses that would be willing to accept it. And then began recruiting from within companies in the area to, but it wasn't really until Alfred Bloomingdale came on board, the aforementioned Alfred Bloomingdale, who had this massive network of friends working in the nightclub industry and owning nightclubs, who really helped consolidate and establish a very high-end merchant network.
So it spread at first through this kind of emergent class mm-hmm. of middle management. It was seen as being a status thing within that kind of environment.
Oh, absolutely.
But it had utility too.
Absolutely. There's tons of newspaper coverage from the time talking about the marvels of this new card and describing that anyone would be enormously impressed by someone whose own signature was as good as the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury's signature. And talking about how the card was, well, there's a study that is widely publicized and probably made up by the Diners Club marketing team that shows that people thought of the card as a symbol of unlimited potency. That if you had...
The song to the movie, the introductory mm-hmm. song to the movie, I can't remember exactly, but the song is essentially, women will have sex with you if you have a Diners Club card.
Well, I guess that's all it took.
Card marketing was so much easier in those days.
Well, the Diners Club was absolutely like a club. If you were a member, that meant you had special privileges. That meant that the world was your country club, because at the end of the month, you got your itemized country club style bill.
You paid it.
Yep.
So how did it grow across its first sort of decade then?
So one of the ways it grew was that Diners Club began marketing explicitly to women. Diners Club began what they called a women's bureau, which tried to think of ways that suburban housewives could use their card. Interestingly, it was never seen as family money or money that could be spent on domestic duties or, you know, stuff for the kids. It was always curler or getting your hair done, buying a new outfit, taking your friends to lunch, ordering flowers. All these very sophisticated, very adult. It was a travel and entertainment card for men, and it was a travel and entertainment card for women as well. However, Working women also began to use the card in the same way, though, that the housewives' diners club cards were complimentary cards to their husbands. Working women's cards were always issued by their employer. We have quite a bit of advice columns for working girls in the 1950s and 60s that advocate things like using your card when you take a male client out to dinner. Because if you put down the card, then you're not a woman paying for a man's lunch. The company is paying for both of your lunches.
I mean, it's interesting you say that, because one of my favorite books about the origins of the credit card is the Edward Bellamy Looking Back from 2000 to 1888, which is unknown outside the US, but in the US at the time was a classic bestseller. But
Bellamy's vision for the card was sort of a socialist utopia, though, where you would be able...
No, I said I put it on my blog. It was like Disneyland, but run by Kim Jong-il. Which I thought was, but that was the fashionable utopianism at the time. But to me, one of the most interesting lines in the book is when... he says, his first question, when he showed a credit, well, it's not actually a credit card, it's a pre-authorized debit card, but when he's shown the card, his first question is, can women use it? Because that was considered a sort of shocking. And so, like, it's very interesting. We get to get into the mass market, diners club, actually, you would probably say, was maybe a little ahead of the time.
Perhaps. Other stories we hear future... Helen Gurley Brown, who would later go on to be the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine, advised working women to make extensive use of their Diners Club card because, as she put it, bosses were frequently miserable misers about raises and salary, but indulgent sugar daddies when it came to padded expenses. So,
my finance director isn't, I can assure you.
Well, maybe you're not as pretty as Helen Gurley Brown.
I think you may well be right about that. So this brings us through to, like, round about the time of this. So Diners Club had been successful. It was growing. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems, from looking back from now, it seems very difficult scaling problems. This was all done manually with telephone authorization and carbon paper. But nevertheless, it worked. It was profitable. It was a growing business. Mm-hmm. We come through to the sort of time of the movie. And then things took a different turn. And broadly speaking, Diners Club became not the dominant mainstream card product at the time these began to move to the mainstream. So from your position looking back at it, why is that? I won't say what went wrong, because Diners Club is still a successful business, but how come Diners Club didn't become the mainstream card that everyone has?
Well, I would say that it was attacked on the high end of the market by American Express, which of course had in fact invested more heavily in computerization and did have a much more sophisticated modern system and had an established brand. Even though the American Express card only came out in the late 60s, it had been around forever, offering traveler's checks and that sort of thing.
So because they were the challenger, not the incumbent, they chose to invest in technology as a...
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right.
And they were trusted in money, because the traveler's checks were a trusted brand in money.
Absolutely. I mean, there are stories from World War I where the Americans trapped in Europe when World War I broke out, who had American Express, were the only ones who could really get access to their money. And it's an interesting contrast. The marketing, Diners Club is very swank and populux and sort of 1960s glamour. American Express has their Centurion, has this neoclassical imagery that really looks like, you know, banking. So it definitely caught on among the sort of higher end executive class.
Was this because of their marketing, or because of the, or was it just really the computerization meant they could offer lower rates to the merchants?
I think it was really a mix of all three. I'm not really sure that it was an issue of lower rates to merchants, but I think that the computerization made it for a more efficient market. On the low end of the market, of course, by the late 60s, they were also threatened by Bank AmeriCard, which was, in fact, the first true credit card, so attached to a line of rotating credit. And we see an interesting shift in the marketing there as well. Unlike Diners Club, which had previously advertised to men and women in these very separate spheres, so the traveling businessman taking his clients out to dinner and the housewife getting her hair done, we begin to see it really marketing to people as a family unit. We have the early Think of It as Money campaigns that really encourage families to say, think of it as money for household expenses. Think of it as money There's one great billboard with a man holding twins, and it says, "Think of it as money for the unexpected." So you really have this shift from being all about travel and entertainment, being this symbol of unlimited potency, to a store of value that to cover unexpected needs, a stopgap that families can use as they need it.
So what I take from this is that we should be whispering in Hollywood producers' ears with some good ideas for movies that have mobile wallets as the crucial plot device. So perhaps after a couple of drinks, we'll come up with something good. Thank you very much for your time, Lana. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Tomorrow's Transactions, the Consult Hyperion podcast series. For more information, please come and visit www.tomorrowstransactions.com.